it's time for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. President Trump has pardoned two ranchers whose case led to an armed standoff at a wildlife refuge in Oregon. A Republican representative is facing questions over what he knew about abuse in the Ohio State Athletic Program. And President Trump kicked off the NATO summit by criticizing Germany and other allies for not paying their share of a mutual defense budget. We'll also look at a generational gap in Democratic Party leadership. And our question of the week for you is, whatever party you lean toward, would you like to see more young people helping to run it? Would younger people bring different priorities or more campaign success? Or do you think having a career's worth of experience is key to getting things done? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Scott Wong is a senior reporter at The Hill. He joins us from the U.S. Capitol building today. Scott, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back.
So yesterday, President Trump pardoned two ranchers in Oregon whose imprisonment helped lead to an armed occupation of a wildlife refuge in 2016. Give us a little more background on the case.
Well, that's right. I mean, people probably remember a little bit more about the armed standoff on an Oregon wildlife refuge where police actually shot one of the occupiers dead. But what triggered all of that was this father and son duo, Dwight and Stephen Hammond, who were convicted of setting a brush fire that later spread onto some federal land. And this is all sort of this part of this fight that's been happening across, western lands, western federal lands of landowners, clashing with the federal government over proper use of and access to federal lands. And so this is one of the more famous cases that has resulted of these clashes. And, of course, political watchers have seen a trend with some of President Trump's pardons. The trend is that it looks like Trump is pardoning many of his defenders and supporters in recent months, including conservative pundit Dinesh D'Souza, who was convicted of campaign finance crimes during the Obama years, and then more recently Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the Arizona sheriff who was convicted in a case related to racial profiling. He's now running for the U.S. Senate in Arizona. And so it's been interesting to sort of figure out a lot of these pardons come unexpectedly, but it's been interesting to watch who Trump is actually pardoning here.
And those pardons, like you said, Sheriff Joe Arpaio, Dinesh D'Souza, are those similar types of pardons that other presidents have made during their own administrations?
Well, I think that there is a concern among Democrats and critics that these are political allies and that, that many of the people being pardoned are not necessarily people who were convicted unfairly, but maybe are being pardoned perhaps because of their political allegiances to this president. Now, I will say there's one notable exception, Jack Johnson. He's the African-American boxing legend who was convicted way back in 1913 for taking his white girlfriend across state lines. For years and years, John McCain had pushed for his pardon, and Trump, after listening to many people, including McCain, agreed to the pardon. And I would also say Sylvester Stallone was a big part of making that pardon happen. Trump likes celebrities and went ahead and pardoned Jack Johnson posthumously.
Going back to this pardon of the two ranchers in Oregon that the president made yesterday, what have we heard from the White House about the reasoning for this particular pardon?
I cover Capitol Hill and did not listen to the press conference from the White House, but this obviously plays well to the president's base, and I think that's what's most important here. These are people that believe in smaller government, that believe that the federal government should not be exerting its power over a lot of these federal lands, that they should have more access to, have their cattle graze on these lands. And so, I think this is probably a very smart political move for the president in that it plays well for his base.
And before we move on, Scott, the tension over land rights, as you said, in the West has not gone away. I believe I saw that half of Oregon land is actually federally owned. So in that state especially, it's a huge issue. Is there concern in light of this pardon that it might embolden more people to take action? And as you said, there was actually a loss of life in the occupation of the wildlife refuge. Might this embolden people to take action on federal land?
I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's entirely possible. As you know, this is an issue that people are very passionate about, and in the case of the Oregon Wildlife Refuge standoff, that was an armed conflict. Almost everybody had a weapon, and that did result in a loss of life, and so people are willing to die over this issue.
We're talking with Scott Wong. He's a senior reporter at The Hill, and we're taking our weekly look at some of the top political stories out of Washington. Let's move on to Republican Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio. He's actually a former UW-Madison wrestler, and he's facing accusations that he failed to address sexual abuse while he was a wrestling coach or part of the wrestling coaching staff at Ohio State University. What specifically is being alleged?
Well, about a half dozen wrestlers are alleging that Jim Jordan knew back in the 80s and 90s that a teen doctor by the name of Richard Strauss was molesting and sexually abusing not only student college wrestlers under the watch of Jim Jordan, but athletes in a bunch of different sports, I think 14 different sports. And so this is obviously a huge political bombshell, not only because it involves, it comes in the wake of the Larry Nassar scandal at Michigan State University, but also because Jim Jordan was seen as somebody that was about to perhaps make a run for Speaker of the House to succeed Paul Ryan, who is stepping aside next year. He is the founding chairman of the very conservative House Freedom Caucus, which was partly responsible for pressuring John Boehner out of the speakership back in 2015. This is a high-profile individual, and also Jim Jordan has been at the center of the DOJ case, one of President Trump's top defenders in the Russia investigation as a key member of the oversight and judiciary committees. And so it's a earthquake of a political story here on Capitol Hill.
Well, and Representative Jordan has been very defiant and saying that he did not have any knowledge of the abuse. Here he is addressing that.
Conversations in a locker room are a lot different than people coming up talking about abuse. No one ever reported any abuse to me. If they had, I would have dealt with it. And what bothers me the most is the guys that are saying this thing, I know they know the truth. I know they do.
And so, Scott, what about the timing of this? Why is this coming out right now?
Well, it's coming out right now because one of the athletes who sort of precipitated this brought up these concerns of alleged abuse to the university back in April. Now, Jim Jordan wasn't pulled into this until over the 4th of July recess. What he's alleging is perhaps this is a political hit job because he's thinking about running for Speaker of the House, and he has defended President Trump in the Russia probe against the DOJ and Rod Rosenstein. And so he believes politics are at play here. What's interesting to me is today Speaker Ryan very vociferously defended Jim Jordan. He called him a good friend and a man of honesty and a man of integrity. That's some pretty strong words for the Speaker of the House, who at this point, did not need to stick his neck out for Jim Jordan. A couple of other members of the leadership team, Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise, the number two and the number three leaders in Republican leadership, also were very defensive of Jim Jordan and gave a staunch defense of him in statements they issued earlier this week. So far, nobody within the Republican Party is throwing Jim Jordan under the bus. I think that's an interesting and telling development. And I would also point out that the president is standing by Jim Jordan. So it's what it's sort of turned into as a he said thing, because you have a number of wrestlers that are alleging that Jim Jordan knew about this stuff and tried to perhaps cover it up. And you have a number of coaches and other wrestlers who are saying there's no possible way that Jim Jordan could have known about it. It's now being investigated independently by university investigators. They've contracted out to an outside law firm, and this could take months and months to figure out.
We're talking with Scott Wong right now. He's senior reporter at The Hill, and we're looking at the top national political stories of the week. When we come back, after a short break, we are going to talk about a generational leadership gap in the Democratic Party, and we want you to weigh in on our question of the week at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see younger leaders in the political party you favor? What change do you think more youthful leadership would bring about? Or do you think political experience and a record on the issues is more important? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Scott Wong, senior writer at The Hill, checking in on the top political news of the week. And Scott, you recently wrote a piece about a bit of a generational tension in the Democratic Party. There seems to be a question of whether party leadership needs to be made up of the most senior members of the caucus or a place to bring up new young leadership. What's causing this to bubble up to the surface right now?
Well, the one main event that sort of triggered this was the defeat of Joe Crowley up in New York. Joe Crowley was the number four House Democrat, a very powerful man seen as somebody that eventually could rise to be a new Speaker of the House one day. He was unseated unexpectedly by a 28-year-old upstart named Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's a millennial. She's a self-described Democratic socialist. She's Latina. And really, this got the ball rolling and got the conversation going on Capitol Hill about whether it's time to have new leadership in the Democratic caucus of the House, whether it's time for Nancy Pelosi and her number two and number three officials to step aside. These are all three folks who are in their late 70s, who have held on to power for more than a decade. And it's created a little bit of a logjam at the top, where people who are looking to move up the leadership ladder are finding there's no place to go. And so a lot of them are running for state offices or even for L.A. County supervisor local positions, which is very unusual once you're in Congress. And so now there is there's just a lot of tension and a real push to perhaps get some new leadership up there.
Before we go to the phones, let's take a quick listen to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking about what Nancy Pelosi told her after her primary win.
She said that she loved working with Joe, but that she's actually always wanted younger women in Congress, and that men tend to run at younger ages and women tend to run at older ages, and that she's actually very happy to see, some new blood, you know. And, I look forward to meeting her in that chamber.
Again, that was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who pulled out that upset in the Democratic primary in New York. Let's go to the phones, and Mara in La Crosse is up first. Hi, Mara.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, my comment is that while experience is definitely to be valued, having new faces, younger faces representing us is definitely something that I would look forward to. And my hope would be that because these younger people are kind of less tarnished by corruption and less likely to make decisions based on keeping favor, they might be able to represent better. And they are also kind of a more diverse generation, meaning that they could speak to the population a little better and really represent the people they're supposed to be representing.
Thanks so much for the call, Mara. And actually, Randy in Madison, I think, has a little different take on this. Let's go there. Hi, Randy.
Hi, yes. I hope I basically understood the issue, because I'm thinking more in terms of the party infrastructure. Robert Strauss used to be the party chairman, I think way back in the 80s, used to said that when Republicans nominate somebody, they turn them over to campaign professionals who've had, you know, 30, 40 years of experience, know exactly what to do and get their candidate on the map and everything. And Democrats turn them over to some young live wire who spends 80% of their time reinventing the wheel. And so I've seen that unbalance for so long that young candidates are fine, but I really wish they would start, the Democrats would start valuing the experienced party movers.
Thanks for that call, Randy. So, Scott, a couple different angles there from Mara and Randy. Mara really likes the energy and the idealism and the diversity that younger people in the party can bring. Randy saying that young people, young candidates often don't seem to be done a great service by the Democratic leadership in how they are kind of brought up through the ranks. What are you seeing as far as what the Democratic leadership is thinking about how they might be able to, if they value it, bring in more young leaders?
Well, Nancy Pelosi actually has tried to bring in some new leaders. She recognized this problem after the 2016 rout where Republicans just killed Democrats, not only winning the White House, but also preserving the House and the Senate. And she made, as there was agitation in the rank and file, she made decisions to bring younger members to create more leadership spots on her team at the very low rungs of the leadership ladder. But she brought in some young people. That has not appeased them. They are looking to have representation in the top three or four positions. Again, as I mentioned, these have been occupied by Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer of Maryland, and Jim Clyburn of South Carolina for about a dozen years. And so, you know, a lot of what I'm hearing from Nancy Pelosi allies and allies of some of these older leaders is that experience matters and that these people have been in the trenches, and that if you want people who know what they're doing going up against somebody like Donald Trump and the Republicans, then you need people who have been in the trenches, who have been in these fights before, not some political newcomers.
Before we move on, Scott, I want to ask, is there any comparable feeling on the Republican side that they need to be bringing up the next generation of leadership?
What's interesting is that Democrats always say that they are sort of the party of young people and the millennials, but it's actually the Republican Party, at least when you look at the House, who are comprised of young, much younger leaders. Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, somebody from your state, is in his late 40s. The number two and number three officials, Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise, are in their 50s. And again, the Democrats' top leadership are all in their 70s. So there is an enormous generational gap between the Democratic leadership and the Republican leadership. It's just sort of happened that way through a number of, you know, political defeats, including the ouster of John Boehner back in 2015 that I mentioned. But the Republican leadership has a much younger face than the Democratic leadership.
I want to move on to the NATO summit that's going on right now in Belgium. President Trump is there, and he's been airing some grievances about and to several allies. What have we been hearing from him so far at the summit?
Well, as Trump often does, he shocked Washington and the foreign policy community on the first day of the NATO summit out in Brussels by taking some swipes at NATO allies, basically saying that they are not paying their fair share of the NATO defense budget, which has been established at 2% of GDP of those nations, and complaining that the U.S. has had to cover for some of those nations. He called those allies delinquent and took specific aim at Germany and Angela Merkel of Germany for what he essentially said was being hypocritical, because Germany has struck a gas pipeline deal with Russia, known as Nord Stream 2, while at the same time saying that they need to be defended from Russia. And so he really opened the NATO summit with a bang.
And what has the congressional response been to the president's remarks?
Not very good. I was in a press conference this morning with Speaker Ryan, and he said while he doesn't want to criticize President Trump while he's overseas, he did point out that he called NATO indispensable to the United States. And in fact, the House passed a resolution today affirming their support of NATO on the very day or just hours after the President of the United States sort of bashed NATO. And so there is sort of this discord between the president's message and the message that is being sent by Congress. I will say, however, that Ryan said he shared many of Trump's concerns that allies are not paying enough into the NATO defense budget, and that he agreed with President Trump's larger point, while maybe his messaging would have been a little bit different.
And Scott, as we start to wrap up, what would be the next step in President Trump trying to get the allies to pay more, or the allies to kind of say, hey, you know, we're doing, as Angela Merkel said, we do other things besides paying into the pot?
Well, I think that, you know, I was looking at some of the numbers today, just diving into them, and it does look like there are a handful of countries that have met that 2% GDP goal already, and the other countries are saying that they are striving to get there. I think there's a period of time in which they are allowed to hit that target goal. And so I think to a certain extent, Trump's rhetoric has worked in getting some of the other NATO allies to open up their wallets and to pitch in. But I think it is the president's style and rhetoric that has sort of rubbed some of our NATO allies the wrong way.
Scott, thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Scott Wong is a senior reporter at The Hill. He was with us for our weekly check-in on national political news.